Today, and I appreciate the invitation. I'm unfortunately going to have to deal with inversion with constraints today. My son is graduating from high school, so I have to head back to Calgary, but I hope that we can continue the inversion sessions for other PIMS seminars in the future. In fact, with my talk on geophysical inversion, I would greatly encourage Gary and Mike and the other organizers of inversion sessions to consider a place where we can look at real rocks, and maybe Banff would be a good one, because it's always good to know what model parameters one is dealing with. So what I want to talk to you about today is a paper that came out in Geophysics. It's kind of a philosophical paper. Came out in the January-February issue of Geophysics. And it's kind of a look back, a look at the present, and a look at the future of geophysical inversion. And like most future forecasts, there will be large prediction errors, I'm sure. But I would like to share with you some of my opinions on where I think inversion is going and the many challenges that we face in this area. And with Martin's talk and the previous speaker's talk about tomography, I think it really introduces us to many of the aspects of geophysical inversion. And many of the common themes that we find in many other fields, such as medical imaging and materials testing, and many of the themes are common, but there are also differences that are important to realize as well. So it's fun to work on this paper with my mentor. that is an illumination zone problem there, shadow zone. Sven Tritel, who influenced many of my ideas on inversion. Much of this work was done at Amoco, some at Memorial, and now at University of Calgary. So at the turn of the millennium, we should really look at where we've been and where we are and where we're going. And to do that, let's look first at a definition of geophysical inversion. What do we define as geophysical inversion? This is one definition that's maybe a little more general than some you may see in the literature, but it's so general that it includes just about everything we do in geophysics. The definition I give here is from a set of geophysical observations. Data produce the best estimate of an Earth model that is consistent with the data. And I hope you will appreciate that the production of a model that fits the data is a necessary, but not necessarily, is certainly not a sufficient condition for finding the right answer. We have many problems with illumination and singularities, null spaces that don't allow us to always come up with the correct model. But presumably, given the past history of inversion, this is, although it's not perfect as a tool, it's certainly a useful one. And if it weren't, we wouldn't continue to use it in everyday seismic processing and interpretation. Well, first of all, a cartoon that illustrates what I view as forward modeling and inversion. In forward modeling, we have a set of rock parameters, rock properties of the Earth, and the boundaries of that model. And following the laws of physics and using the formulation of that in mathematics and computing, we come up with a model response. In this case, the cartoon shows a synthetic seismogram. In other words, we synthesize how the Earth would respond for a given set of parameters. And this is a very useful procedure, because modeling, as I hope to emphasize, is a very crucial part of the inversion procedure as well. Inversion, in this cartoon, is shown as taking a set of observations. And they are band limited, they are aperture limited, they are noisy, and yet we hope to come up with a model estimate, a model response, basically a response that, or a model estimate such that the response will match that of the real data to within some degree of accuracy. So From our observations, we hope to come up with rock property parameters such as seismic velocities, resistivity perhaps if we're dealing with electrical data, density if we're dealing with gravity data, magnetic susceptibility. I've drawn the cartoon for seismic data, but we could draw the cartoon for geophysical data in general. And in fact, I think it behooves us to realize that the more different observations we have of the Earth, probably the better our picture of the subsurface will be. So this is a cartoon that really relates forward modeling to inversion. So basically what we want to do is to go from what we observe to what we estimate in terms of Earth properties. So this definition includes just about all of geophysics. To do any kind of inversion, we need good data. We need lots of data, and we need different types of data. The example that Martin showed of the Valhall example uses ocean bottom seismometer data. And it's very advantageous to have multi-component observations of the seismic wave field in addition to the traditional vertical component or hydrophone recordings. So acquisition is really the input for inversion. So this really will determine in many ways how good our answer will be, how reliable the model is at the end of the day. Modeling is also a crucial part of the inversion in that the model that we use, our answer will only be as general as the model we use. If we are dealing with geophysical data from Saskatchewan, for example, we could probably get away with a fairly flat layer cake model. Certainly such a model wouldn't work in the overthrust of Alberta, BC, or Wyoming, where we have complicated, steeply dipping, overturned beds. So modeling is a very crucial part of the... In fact, in any inversion, one should have in the back of their mind what type of model they're using. Processing is... in a way, our inversion of going from the data to a more interpretable or a clearer picture, a clearer image of the seismic data sets if we're dealing with seismic data. Interpretation is really in some ways, the final inversion in that it will determine whether one would drill a well or look for hydrocarbons or to look for minerals. So the interpretation is really an analysis of the processed data. And you could think of that as the inversion of the past was mainly in the interpreter's brain. Having a data set, what would be the type of model or the type of picture of the Earth that they would come up with from the data. Another final step that's often ignored is one that... questions, well, I have an answer. How reliable is that answer? If I have a prescribed fit to my data, what if I relax that fit a bit, would my answer vary greatly? And sensitivity analysis of solutions to look at the range of possible models that might still fit the data is also a good thing to do. Often we don't. We find that we found a model that fits, but yet... Yet at the same time, we should always think about what sort of variation, what sort of error bounds would we have in our solutions. This is one type of step in geophysical imaging or seismic imaging termed migration, just basically the process of putting reflected energy into its proper subsurface location. In the sense, this is a structural inversion, trying to find... If we had a seismic response such as this one, this is obviously model data from the Alberta foothills. We had a seismic response such as this. Migration, a depth migration, is basically, in this case, a reverse time procedure, moving the wave field back into the subsurface to the reflectors from which they came. And so instead of trying to interpret... a picture such as this with crisscrossing diffractions and only really accurate in the flat part of the model, we get a much clearer picture of the thrust faulting in this particular part of the foothills. So that migration you could think of as a structural inversion to come up with a clear image of the subsurface given the seismic response. So in the definition we've used here, migration is a type of inversion. That's basically depends on your definition. But to do this type of migration, you really need to know the velocity. To get an image such as this, I've used a known velocity. So in a sense, it's using the answer to get the answer. That's not cheating quite as much as that, because we can use migration as a velocity analysis tool itself. And it's really an iterative procedure, like many inversions, so especially with nonlinear problems, we're taking a series of steps to get to the right answer. And one of the tools for finding the velocity is really to look at depth gathers for common image points. Now, if the answer is correct, the depth image of a scatter point should not depend on the source-receiver offset. So that if our velocity is correct, the depth point will not vary as a function of source-receiver offset. It shouldn't depend on the geometry of our experiment. So this is a case where the velocity is just right. If the velocity is too slow or too fast, we get what are called smiles and frowns. So actually, one inversion method might be to try to automate this process of going from the slow velocity or the fast velocity to one where we flatten out the smiles and frowns. Are there automated ways of doing this? In the past, interpreters may have adjusted the velocities and looked at both these common image gathers with the smiles and frowns and perhaps the focusing or defocusing, much like one adjusts a camera lens to come up with the right velocity picture. Are there ways that we could automate this procedure without the intervention of the interpreter? I hope you don't get the impression in this talk that I'm going to replace interpreters, because I think that ultimately they're the arbiter of all of what we do in processing and inversion methods. But there are, of course, it's a desirable objective to try to automate as much as we can with the computer and to take away much of the drudgery that may be involved in, say, velocity analysis. Let's just look at a little bit of the past to see where we're going in the future. And in the 50s, we had the development of Dix's equation by Hewitt Dix at Caltech, where he basically showed how to go from RMS velocities to interval velocities for layered media. And we have the tool of common depth point stacking, which in a sense is perhaps our most powerful signal-to-noise enhancer. In the earthquake seismology part of things, we saw the advent of the Backus-Gilbert inversion and the issues of resolution and stability in our solutions. And then actually, in many ways, this relates to deconvolution and our resolution of reflection coefficients. One can relate these in terms of resolving kernels. And so much of what was done in earthquake seismology can be related to what's done in exploration seismology, and mainly the terminology difference. But as we get into the 70s, we saw the desire to estimate not only the reflection coefficients, but the contrast in the seismic impedance. Seismic impedance being the product of density times velocity, which results in reflections. But to go from a picture of reflection coefficients to one that it would involve a profile of the seismic impedance in depth. Also, time migration, the imaging of or the collapsing of diffractions to their proper subsurface location. In the 80s, we saw the advent of travel time tomography as a general tool to get the velocities for migration. And this has a lot of some objectives, or the objectives in common with medical tomography, but we find that our experiment is much less constrained, or we do not have the full aperture of sources and receivers that occur in medical tomography. So travel time tomography, I think, still is a viable velocity tool. We see the use of what is called joint inversion, or the attempt to invert all geophysical data sets that result from a from the one Earth that we're trying to basically map in terms of its material properties and its boundaries. Depth migration became a very useful tool in that ultimately we're going to drill in depth. At some point, every geophysicist in the seismic exploration business does a depth migration, because we have to tell the drillers how deep to drill. We don't tell them so many seconds, we tell them so many meters. So that depth migration also obviated many of the problems with lateral velocity variation that time migration sort of scooted around. So this was found to be very useful in imaging salt intrusions and overthrust, places where you get large changes in the seismic velocity. Much of what was done up to this point ignored the true amplitude variation with offset, but it was found that with the many of the gas sand discoveries, that looking at amplitudes in a very rigorous way and looking at the amplitudes variation with offset was a very valuable tool in detecting gas sands. So amplitude versus offset, or amplitude versus angle, became a tool that still today is undergoing a lot of scrutiny and interest. From two ends of things, looking at the generalization of the models to elastic media, to the variation of amplitude with offset, and looking at the processing, because almost everything we do with seismic amplitudes seismic processing distorts amplitudes. So we have to be careful to maintain the integrity of the amplitudes and invert them to some useful subsurface image. Full waveform inversion people have defined as trying to match every wiggle in a seismic trace to come up with a model response that honors every sample in a seismic trace, all amplitudes. This is a very tough problem, because not only do we need a very general model, one that basically models the full elastic wave field, but we also have to deal with the omnipresent noise problem that we have in our data. And another area that involves really inversion or statistics, geostatistics, is prediction between wells of rock properties. Pre-stack depth migration basically is the use of sources and receivers that are not at the same surface location. In other words, we don't do the summation before the migration procedure. We do it within it. The stacking is basically a summation process. And in the end, when we get an answer, we probably want to look at the credibility of that answer. And John Scales and Tad Ulrich and Mauricio and others have looked at the Bayes theorem. There's an excellent paper in that same issue of Geophysics, I believe, the January-February issue on the use of Bayes. To Bayes or not to Bayes was a paper by John Scales, which I think really illustrates many of the ideas of how we should evaluate a solution that we get out of inversion. I hope that we don't view inversion as a black box by any means. Inversion really involves, in at least model-based inversion, in all inversions, we should always be aware of what forward model we're using. How general is it? Is it 1D, two-dimensional, three-dimensional? Is it elastic? Is it isotropic or anisotropic? How general is that model? Does it need to be more general? We should make the model at least as general as the geology we're dealing with, as the rocks we're dealing with. One of the problems may be that we also need to obtain the data to match that model, in other words, 3D seismic sampling and its response. So inversion will The use of practical use of inversion will ultimately depend on the speed and the generality of this step. How fast can we compute these models as well? 3D is no longer a problem that's intractable. With the parallel computing, we can start to generalize our modeling, and we can rethink many of the problems that we felt were intractable previously. In matching the model response to the data, we're ultimately dealing with optimization algorithms in many model-based inversion techniques. Which brings us to the type of error that one would want to minimize in adjusting that model. Classically, we've used least squares for Gaussian distributions. It's fine, and it's very nice and simple, and ever since the days of Gauss, we've used least squares. It has a problem with outliers, in which case we may want to look at least absolute deviation. Of course, the question is there a best criterion? And I guess to answer that, you'd really need to know the statistics of the residuals or the differences between the model response and the data. There is a nice method that was actually, I think, originally discovered or worked on by a guy named Roger Boscovich. But it was involving reweighted least squares, and the attempt here is to use the least squares vehicle and at the same time get some of the robustness of the L1 norm. Basically, to solve the problem, you set it up as an LP norm, and P is usually between 1 and 2. If you minimize this, you get something that's very similar to the normal equations, except in the middle there's a weighting matrix. And the weighting of the observations is really going to be related to the size of the residual. If P equals 2, though the case of least squares, then it's just our old friend, the normal equations. If P equals 1, we'll essentially downweight our data by the size of the residual. In other words, instead of throwing out what we think are large residuals or differences between data and model responses, this technique would downweight the large residuals. And in a sense, any outliers would be downweighted by this procedure. Of course, you have to build in a criterion for the case of Ri equals 0, the perfect fit, using an epsilon voiding divided by 0. So really, we can, in a sense, get an L1 norm type of performance in it by iteratively applying this to with a least squares algorithm, basically iteratively reweighting our solutions and applying least squares out. So it's L1 performance with an L2-like algorithm. And John Scales and Adam Gerstenkorn use this a lot in their work in tomography. It's very easy to apply, because if you have a normal equation solver, you just, after the first iteration, you start plugging in for this weighting matrix. So the least square solution would look like this. The least absolute deviation would be achieved by an iterative, by setting p equal to 1 and iteratively applying this. And this has been mentioned in the literature. Also, to regularize our problem or to avoid problems of singularities, what we often do is to use Lagrange multipliers and put a basically try to minimize the sum of the L2 norm and the size of the parameters. And this is known as the Marquardt-Levenberg or damped least squares. There is another approach to this, and that is to use penalties on roughness functions, such as Constable et al. Prescribed, and that is to minimize the sums of squares of the differences between data and model response with the smoothest and put a constraint on a smoothness constraint, difference of differences on our parameters. So this approach is finding the smoothest model that's consistent with the data, and this is called Occam's inversion, the simplest solution that's still consistent with the data. These aren't necessarily going to give the same answer, especially in mixed parameter systems where we might be dealing with velocity and geometry or different clusters of the eigenvalues. This is an example out of Constable's paper for resistivity. in which he shows the blue is the smoothness constraint, the Ockham inversion, and the yellow curve is the Marquardt model. So they, although in many cases they're similar, they're not always the same. Which is right? Well, that's really the question. In many ways, if you're dealing with mixed parameters, it's probably better to use the Ockham's inversion or the smoothness constraint. Well, we all know, those of us that have dealt with inversion, that they're ill-posed problems. We'll have, our data are not adequate to, the frequencies are not, for example, broad enough. They're band-limited data, so that we only really solve for our answers within that frequency band limit. The solutions are non-unique and do not depend continuously on the data. There is but one correct solution, but mathematically, sometimes one can get, many times you can get model fits that fit the data equally well. And then I think it behooves us to look at the physics of what is realistic, and perhaps to put constraints based on rock properties, such as the density of a rock. Generally, for most sedimentary rocks, it would be around somewhere between 2 and 3 grams per cubic centimeter, for example. We know something about velocities from well logs. We can put constraints that do, to some degree, obviate the non-uniqueness problem. It's always with us, but it may decrease the ambiguities, is probably a better way to say it. And to throw as much information at it as we can. This is an example from a paper by Kolb, Colino, and Lely, Patrick Lely, in France. And here is he illustrates this problem of the limited frequency of our data and how crucial the initial guess sometimes is on determining the final solution to a problem. This is just a source gather for a certain set of offsets. Obviously, it's so clean, it's synthetic. But this is considered a data set, and this would be the response for some initial guess. Ultimately, what we want to do is to get a good fit to the data. Now, one thing that Lely did show is that in getting a better and better fit to these data, is that he put in a trend, first of all. The dashed line is his velocity profile, and the red line shows the progression of the model as he's fitting his data better and better. But this is a very promising example here, where if he put in the red line trend for the velocity and allowed it to iterate, I forget how many iterations it took, but around a dozen iterations or so, and fitting the seismic amplitudes, you get to a pretty good fit of the yellow dashed line in terms of a velocity profile. So all looks to be well and good here. However, we know about the low frequency problem in inversion, and the fact that usually 0 to 5 hertz is really not contained in our seismic data. It's a blind zone, essentially null space problem. So what happens if we started out with a worse initial guess, one that didn't have the trend in it? Well, we can get a good fit to the data, but without the proper DC level or trend. In fact, this, believe it or not, this velocity model can give us a good fit, a seismic response that fits the data. And Lely showed this in his paper. So sometimes many times we can fit the data and have the wrong model. In this case, the low frequency part is not really contained in our data, so that in our inversion, it's not really correctly estimated. To circumvent that problem, we'd use well logs. We put in information, for instance, marry the well log data or any other information that we had in that 0 to 5 hertz zone with the data we have. So it would be a marriage of log data and seismic data that we use to try to get the best model. And again, a lot was gained from working with John Scales. You can probably appreciate that, Martin. But this was actually Martin Smith, John Scales, and Terry Fisher's paper, where they showed an error surface of what we... you can think of optimization or inversion as trying, if this was an error surface, we're trying to get to the deepest valley here. And this is for a statics problem. We're shifting the seismic trace to minimize the error. Or if you wanted to go to the highest, take 1 minus the error, we'd want to go to the highest peak. So we're looking for peaks or valleys. Another good reason for having our meeting in Banff. We can go through mountain climbing. So the global solution to this would be, if we were maximizing the 1 minus the error, we'd try to hit the highest peak. But many of our algorithms, our least squares algorithms, would go to local solutions in the local high peaks or the local deep valleys, so that it would find a local extremum. What do we do to solve that problem? This is really the difference between the local minimization and the global minimization problem. Well, one thing we can do is use global optimization, but it may take an infinite amount of time to converge. Monte Carlo searches. One can use simulated annealing, which may take the locally bad strategy to get to another set of valleys and try to find the deepest valley. Or you can look at genetic algorithms, as they did in this paper. So that there's a whole range of possibilities here with regard to the optimization problem, global or local. So one approach that I kind of liked was one that Peter Carey and Chris Chapman used, and that was to find, do a Monte Carlo search for different valleys. And then once you're in the valley, use the damped least squares to find the locally deepest point. So it's really combining, in a sense, local and global methods. And then they also performed a sensitivity analysis in the neighborhood of that global minimum. So sensitivity analysis was to find a solution and then look at the degree of non-uniqueness or uncertainty in that solution is a good thing to do. I'm kind of running out of time, but I just want to make a long story short. The sensitivity analysis often depends on how closely you're fitting your data, what sort of error you will allow, and also the singular value. The small singular values may lead to wild oscillations in the solution and still allow you to fit the data. So the question becomes, how small a singular value should we allow? What to do about it? Winnow or regularize? Or basically, the idea is to obtain resolution and stability in our results. So we find the edgehog method was developed by Jackson. Find the range of solutions that would still fit the data. So where are we going with inversion? Travel time inversion, full waveform inversion, and join inversion. Those were really topics in the 90s that got a lot of attention. The tomography problem, I still think, although it's much more poorly constrained in the medical case, where we can surround the body by sources and receivers. In the case of the geophysical problem, we're dealing with either boreholes or the surface of the earth. We can't afford to do much else. We always are dealing with since these rays curve, we are dealing with nonlinear problems. Since they are not illuminating certain zones, we're going to be dealing with null space problems. So that we always have to. Ideally, what we would want to do is to sample these velocity cells with many rays at different angles, as many, and really it's the sampling problems not totally related to the number of data points, as was pointed out by the previous speaker. So that this is a ray-based method. It tries to invert travel to fit all travel times. It was a popular method except by those that had to pick those travel times, and that's probably why travel time tomography is not totally popular, because it's grunt work to get all those bloody travel times. And so that's one of the problems, automatic picking. So really in the 21st century, which we're now in, where is inversion going to? Fully automated? I just don't think so. Full waveform inversion? Well, we always are dealing with noisy data. So it's full waveform inversion is always going to fit the noise as well as the signal. Is it possible? Is it desirable? I kind of think of this as, would we want a fully automated airplane that we'd fly in without a pilot? Would we want surgery done by machines? I don't think we're quite there. I don't know if we'll ever want to be there. Besides which, we're going to put a lot of geophysicists out of business, and that wouldn't be good either, since many of us are in that area. I think one area that that does deserve attention is the nonlinear inversion. This is from Pica and Tarantola's work, matching the full waveform inversion case. I'll just very quickly point out that they dealt with different frequency bands and kind of worked their way, iterated from a low frequency fit, adding higher frequencies in and working backwards from the log to try and get a closer approximation. So much of the work is still iterative. And dealing with, as Martin pointed out, dealing with the elastic problem, in his case, the PS image was a vast improvement over PP. So not only, as Tarantola's group pointed out, to look at P impedance, we should look at the VPVS ratio or Poisson's ratio. There was a great heroic effort by Peter Mora and Albert Tarantola to do everything with general modeling, model the Earth, and fit all data with full waveform. And I think it was courageous, but it is, in addition to be very, very computationally expensive, it is also dealing with an underdetermined problem, a non-unique problem, and fitting the noise. That's a crucial problem. Joint inversion, I think that's going to come into its own in trying to fit all available geophysical data sets with an Earth model. And as I try to point out to the students, geophysical inversion does not just mean seismic inversion. To hope that's not heresy, but basically, in other words, try to throw all the data that you can at a problem, not only the seismic data, in this case it was gravity data and log data, to try to match everything in a certain band. And these have different wavelengths that we're dealing with. They're going to be in different parts of the wavelength spectrum. But to try to come up with a model that in the end, through adjustment to that model, fits all the available data. Finally, debays or not debays, scales and Sneer. And the key point here, I think, is to look at the a priori probability that a model exists, put in constraints. What the probability that a density would ever be less than one for a rock is probably zero. So you would put that in there. Dealing with the likelihood of a solution, and I think that in this case, Bayes, in many ways, does what we do anyhow when we look at a model. How credible? What is the probability that that model is correct given the data that we observe? So maybe it's not a radical thing to do. Maybe we, in a sense, do this in everyday life by looking at our solutions. What will improve geophysical inversion? Well, better data. Efficient use of parallel computing. Maybe the only way to solve these big 3D problems is to hook up a team of huge number of processors and work on problems such as pre-stack depth migration. Improve graphical interfaces. Generalized modeling codes, 4D, time-lapse 3D, integration of data types, interpreters as inverters, or inverters as interpreters. I think that's really a key, to always question the physics of the result that you obtain. And the global optimization problems, again, no guarantee of convergence, but perhaps a more, or I should say, a less ambiguous solution. So I think in the end, what we're going to be doing in inversion is much the same as we have done, with more generality. And the final word on this is taken from John Clairbout's book and combining it with The Drunkard's Walk from George Gamow's book, that inversion theories, like mathematical statistics, should be like a lamppost to light the way and not to lean upon. So I thank you for listening to my talk, and I hope that in the future we have further discussions on inversion. Thank you. Martin.
Yeah, well, maybe a more philosophical question. When you talk about statistics or statistical analysis in the inverse problem, which of course is a very important ingredient, And on the other hand, you talk about your choice of modeling or understanding the modeling of the Earth. A lot of the analysis that has been done is based on finite discrete system theory.
Mm-hmm.
Now, for example, if you believe in the wave equation, and you would investigate the influence of a noise term in the medium on the wave equation, then, well, let's go to the Born approximation. And you can still do something like the Fourier operators. They can be kind of cast into an Itô type of integral, and you can, say, allow for a Brownian motion of your medium or a white noise in your medium. But it's already pretty complicated to deal with that. But if you really want to allow for the full wave or the full waveform solution of the wave equation and add, say, a Brownian motion or a white noise term to your medium coefficients, then you leave, in fact, the world even of Schwarz distributions.
Yes.
It becomes extremely complicated. You have to go to nonlinear algebras of generalized functions to analyze that. Now, the question I have is that is, if you believe in partial differential equations, solution operators, understanding scattering and inverse scattering from that point of view. And on the other side, you have the discrete finite world. Now, what do you think about this gap?
This is really, I guess, the crucial question here is what is the physics of what we're observing, and how close do I have to be with my model to really do a credible job and a useful job of getting an answer or a picture of the Earth? And it's a very deep question, no pun intended, but basically, I think it also relates to how many parameters we use. Is it a parametric or non? I guess non-parametric to me always meant so many bloody parameters. There are too many to be considered parametric. But I think this is a question that one needs to answer through a knowledge of the geological exploration problem you're dealing with in the area, because people are always going to consider the generality and the benefit to cost of what they're doing. And it's become apparent to us that if we drilled a dry hole, for example, in the foothills, many of the lateral mispositioning errors were due to ignoring anisotropy. And that wasn't as much of a problem for flat layer country, because we would probably just drill too deep and we'd hit something. But with the foothills examples we've seen recently, we've been missing the target, and because these rocks are anisotropic, and we hadn't been considering this, so we ignored the physics of anisotropy at our peril. And so that, I think, is really related to the problem of what is the geological problem. How do we relate the physics of inversion to that, and what benefit and what cost, obviously, in exploration? So it's a very good question. I think it's one that any explorationist should ask themselves. Generally, the more a priori knowledge you have of an area, which you will gain through dry holes as well, drilling, the better I think you can answer that question. So that's one that I think everybody should ask. Any others? Okay, well, thanks.